A stranger with a gun came upon two teens taking pictures under a rising full moon. But violence is only the beginning of this story.
Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and I've spent my career talking about how lives are undone by violence. The Letter is a podcast about how lives are remade. Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Dave and Dejanovic, your morning companions for talk, analysis, and key perspectives on Utah's biggest stories on KSL News Radio.
It's called the child care cliff. That at least is how the Deseret News is referring to it this morning in their article that's getting just a ton of traction. We'll speak to the reporter in just a few minutes, Dave Lois Collins, who wrote that story, and also explore. We don't want families in Utah or anywhere going over the cliff when it comes to child care and being able to afford it or find it. So we're also going to deliver some solutions, potentially.
Yeah, and I'll want to know, like, what changed? We had child care things before COVID. So why is all of a sudden there a big cliff that we're about to fall off of when it comes to child care? We've had this problem for decades. This is not a recent thing. It's 9:07. It's time for the launch.
Sequence engaged.
And here are the three things Debbie wants you to know.
Countdown. Three.
I just heard on Utah's Morning News that Target was announcing that it was going to close 9 of its stores in 4 states next month. I don't think Utah's one of those states. We're still checking on that. But they're saying that organized retail theft is threatening the safety of their employees and their customers. I think this is when people like rush into the stores and steal a bunch of stuff. You know, it's not just a problem at Target. It is a problem just about everywhere. Did you see what happened last night in Philadelphia? They said it's a bunch of teenagers just ransacking tons of looting all kinds of merchandise.
Listen to this.
Free iPhones, they're saying.
They're not free iPhones. They're stolen iPhones. And it's going to end brick-and-mortar stores. It has become so easy to steal. The shops don't care about it. They just let it happen. They're not cracking down on it. Police, therefore, cannot arrest anybody. And prosecutors can't charge anybody. Or they can't convict anybody. So the easiest thing to do is exactly what Target is doing. Just get out of the business altogether. Shut down the stores.
Countdown to.
There was a meeting last night in the Jordan School District, and the adults, there's a few of them who spoke out against a transgender girl using the girl's bathroom at the elementary school where she attends in the Jordan District. Now, the child also spoke at the board meeting. That was a surprising moment for me. Here's just a small part of what she said.
I just want the space and acceptance to be me.
It was very hard to listen to little ones talk. Quite honestly, my heart absolutely goes out to this child. And anytime we can make kids more comfortable, I support that. Part of the problem is the way we've designed bathrooms. It is medieval, like these community group, no privacy situations that we've just dealt with forever, for decades. Maybe this is solved by redesigning bathrooms in general. And instead of having these big communal areas where everyone gathers, how about a little privacy?
Launch countdown one.
Well, apparently, we're about to go over this child care cliff. I no longer have to deal with this issue, but I know when I did many years ago, I mean, it was already tough then. So expensive. It was hard to find a place that would take all three of my kids all at once because of their age differences. So now we're running out of this federal money that was infused during the pandemic to financially support and shore up these child care centers that, of course, suffered this major setback when the pandemic basically shut down the world. And I'm reading in the Deseret News here, Dave, that parents are already paying $1,000 a month. And with this money rate running out this weekend, it's this weekend, look for the tuition tab to go up even higher? What?
Well, and I can tell you this. I've talked to some folks that are in this business. One friend specifically said, this is not daycares raking in boatloads of cash. This is not a big money-making endeavor. So they're struggling as well, just like the parents are trying to scramble and find somebody, because both sides are financially strapped, both their provider and the parents.
Dave and Dujanovic.
The launch.
Commence.
Dave and Dujanovic. Special coverage of the top national story.
I don't want only to focus on the, oh my goodness, we're all going to go over this childcare cliff together this weekend. I don't know how quickly the fallout is going to be felt. I know a lot of families are already feeling the pinch because it is so expensive. And as you pointed out, rightfully so, Dave, that daycare centers, they've got a lot of expenses. They've got to pay their employees more to be more competitive and keep employees around. In just a few moments, we're going to focus on some solutions that other states are looking to help you know, mitigate this cliff, if you will.
I wonder how much of this will be solved by the federal government or the state government, and how much will be solved by businesses. We're mm-hmm. starting to see businesses start to provide some sort of child care. If you go work out, you can get child care at, you know, as you lift weights or as you go to spin class, something like that. I wonder if there are alternatives outside of the conventional way we think of daycare, which is drop your kid off, you know, before you go to work and then pick them up after you're done.
That would be such a great idea. And it doesn't have to just be one business. Maybe it's the businesses within a particular block or community or neighborhood that get together and do it. And, you know, there's another issue to that, which would help resolve a lot of angst for a lot of parents. And that is when your child is at a daycare facility 10 miles away near your home that you dropped them off at, or near the school where they got picked up from and dropped off at in the afternoon. And something happens, mom and dad are downtown or 20 miles away, that is just, that's all kinds of crazy, right? You're just trying to run there. And if they're at the place where you're working, oh, that could be lovely.
Well, okay. Tell me, wouldn't that be a benefit? So often we take jobs because of the benefits.
Totally.
We either like the health care.
Yeah.
If that was offered mm-hmm. back when you had kids and you were scrambled around with their care, what would you be willing to sacrifice as far as time, money, and job satisfaction if that was one of the benefits?
Well, I think it would boost job satisfaction.
Oh, absolutely.
Right? Because you're not so stressed trying to figure out what to do and how to care for your kids when they're so many miles away. No, I would love that. In fact, we talked about that here. That was brought
up
here a long time ago. I've been working here since 2000. So, yeah.
That was a suggestion.
It was a suggestion. It got floated and then it got scuttled or something. I don't know what happened, but I would love that idea. So the New York Times, Deseret News, they've really done a lot of reporting. And Deseret News has done a great job laying it all out. But basically, you're looking at 43% of child care centers who were surveyed said that they would have to raise tuition when these grants run out at the end of September, which is this weekend. So we're up against this deadline. It's going to happen. The money is not going to be reinfused. It's going to happen. And then 22% said they'd have to cut staff and they would be able to serve fewer children. We know if there are fewer places at a child care center, that means the supply is not going to meet demand. And so therefore what happens, you know,
prices skyrocket.
Prices go up. Lois Collins from the Deseret News is walking into studio right now. She's the one who did this amazing story. It really spells out the problem. If you haven't had a chance to check it out, please do so at Deseret.com. She's going to also help us parse through some solutions that some states have come up with. Unfortunately, none of them in Utah, but maybe Utah lawmakers can take a page out of one of these states' playbooks. So let's stick around and listen to what Lois has found out in terms of solutions to this looming cliff.
Dave and Dujanovic. Special coverage of the top national story.
We're talking about this child care cliff when this federal pandemic money runs out for child care that was infused into daycare centers across America. Runs out this weekend. And it's not going to be reinfused. We're done with that. But David, I wanted to ask a question of Lois Collins, who's the Deseret News reporter, who's been writing about this issue. What are those possible solutions that are being looked at?
Yeah, it's something we've been struggling with for a long time. I think after the pandemic, it's very easy to focus on the negatives. I think it's also opened up some unique opportunities. Mm-hmm. Think about remote working. That was not a thing before the pandemic. Now, all of a sudden, the flexibility in schedules, employers are realizing, oh, maybe that is possible. So there's maybe a hybrid schedule that is a part of this solution. It's very hard to kind of shift our brains, I think, because we think, oh, drop the kids off before work, pick them up after we're done. And I think there's more nuance to it nowadays.
Lois Collins with the Deseret News. Just incredible reporting. You've looked into so many angles on this issue that's looming. And one of those angles is it's now at $985 a month, you were saying, on average, to put one child in daycare.
So, and infants are really expensive. So if you're in Washington, D.C., it's over $400 a week for an infant. In Alabama, it's only $128, and I say only $128. You multiply that by the number of weeks in a month, and that's a lot.
Yeah, it starts.
And if you have two kids, then yikes.
I've often thought maybe one of the solutions is more of a private sector solution where companies offer this as a benefit. Maybe that's laced with controversy, but maybe companies get together in the same area and sort of subsidize a daycare center for their employees. It was just a thought.
And that has been happening. I mean, Intermountain Healthcare has some daycare down at least one location that I know of. The health department has an on-site daycare. It's not a pure benefit in that it's not that you can just bring your kid no cost, but that has been done a lot of places. But the trick is scale. You know, it's complicated. So you have to know that you have enough employees who would need it at a certain time. I heard you mention earlier that maybe you combine, everybody on a block and a busy block comes up with one, but you got to think about liability and licensing and a bunch of other things. So it's not just as easy as saying, hey, let's just offer daycare starting Tuesday.
Yeah. So what is it that is leading us to this quote unquote child care cliff?
So daycare centers were already in, and I say centers, that includes both home and center-based, but say a household where somebody has five kids from the neighborhood or whatever, they were already struggling financially. It is very hard to find employees right now in a lot of sectors, but in the daycare sector, the average wage is something like $12 an hour. Why would you do that when you could go work at, Costco or somewhere for much more than that? I think even McDonald's now in a lot of places beats the wage of a daycare center. So that was one of the problems. Then when the pandemic first started, people quit taking their kids to daycare because they couldn't. Daycares couldn't take in the kids in a lot of cases because of regulations. But also, families were sent home. So why would you take your kid to daycare? So they struggled with that. Then when kids came home from school, I mean, just a whole bunch of things all happened at once. But even before the pandemic ever started, they said that nationally we were 3.6 million slots short of what was needed for daycare.
So we were already heading toward a cliff.
Yeah. And now they're predicting that if something isn't done, we're going to lose 3 million more slots. So we would be, 6 million, 7 million short of slots. At the same time that people are, we're encouraging people to work. We're talking about if you want to receive, especially in the low income people who have safety net programs, we want a work requirement for them. They shouldn't just get a free ride. But they have to have daycare in that case, too. If you don't have kids, you don't qualify. If you do have kids, then you have to have a place to put your kids if you have young kids. And all of that is bumping up against our whole national fertility crisis. So it's just a really complicated kind of a mess right now.
Lois Collins with the Deseret News has done an in-depth report on the daycare cliff, the childcare cliff that is looming with the pandemic money running out this weekend, concerns about lack of space, maybe daycare centers needing to shut down. There was a survey that you looked at that 43% of child care center directors said they would have to raise tuition, which is already on average $985 a month for one child. Let's talk about what you found with solutions that are being worked on in Congress. Is there anything?
So the first thing that comes to mind is that Nancy Mace and Ro Khanna, he's a Democrat from California and she's a Republican from South Carolina, have put together a coalition. It's a bipartisan caucus on the issue. So they haven't done anything yet, except for agreed that it's a big crisis and put together this bipartisan caucus. But, you know, the word bipartisan and Congress just thrills me right now because there's just not a lot of that. So maybe they will come up with solutions. Khanna has said that he would like to see, and he is working on legislation, but the details are not really available yet. But his goal is parents, one assumes it would be income eligibility, but parents would pay $10 a day out of pocket, and daycare providers would be, you know, if you worked in a daycare center, you would make $20 an hour. We'll have to see what the details are on that and how that would come about. Some states have put money in. Some states, like Utah, have put money into early childhood education to try to get people to stay. So it's been in the form of like a bonus, a one-time, here's $2,000 for people who work in this. You know, my kid got one. She works in an after-school program. So there are different efforts like that. There have been more comprehensive things. I think that New York, Vermont, and Minnesota have all tried to stretch out the pandemic aid themselves by cobbling together finances themselves. You see some states are talking about some sort of a partnership where the family, the state government, and some federal funds, as well as employee funds, it would come out to about a third, you know.
Would all pay into
where they
it?
Would each contribute.
Okay.
That's a possible solution that's being discussed. Virginia put money in, but its plan counts on a federal match that may or may not be there with this money disappearing.
So it sounds like all of these solutions, at least that you're speaking of, are either state-run or federally run. It is some sort of
still
grant.
Government.
It's still government money. Yep. And the reason we're talking about this is because the American Rescue Plan, which had set aside about $24 billion in grants and subsidies for childcare, that money is exhausted. That's gone, you said, by the end of the month?
Right. And it's important to point out that that money was specifically for the centers themselves. It was direct to centers as opposed to subsidizing families.
It's not going to the parents.
So,
who
no,
can
it never went to the parents. It went to the centers to pay for, you know, higher wages, to pay for utilities, mortgage, that kind of thing.
Lois, before we let you go, we have about a minute left. You've been doing so much reporting on this. What do you see in your crystal ball down the road for families if we stay where we're at right now?
I think if we stay where we are right now, people who are in rural areas, people who are low income, are going to have a very hard time, and they may be forced out of the workplace. And the bad thing about that is if you're forced out of the workplace, then you can't advance. You're stuck in place. And so I think that that's a real possibility.
Lois Collins, thank you for joining us and for your reporting from the Deseret News. You can read Lois's article. Just go to Deseret.com.
Our conversation is far from over, Lois. I know you got to run, but make sure you tune in the 11 o'clock hour. We actually have a coworker here. He just told us that his daycare expenses were just increased. I thought they were already wildly, expensive. Carlos is going to join us. He said he's now concerned that this is going to increase his daycare costs even more. And I know when he went to find daycare for his daughter, it was already hard. There was such a shortage of it back then.
Yeah, waiting list.
Yeah, so we're going to get an update on Carlos's situation in the 11 o'clock hour. We've also reached out to our listeners as well on Facebook and asked them, how much are you paying a month for daycare? So that is something to look forward to in our 11 o'clock hour today.
Dave and Dujanovic. Special coverage of the top local story.
At the heart of this issue, this controversy, if you will, that we're going to talk about right now, there's school children. And there's a school bathroom. And everybody at school needs to use the bathroom. So let's just agree, right? Everybody needs to use the bathroom at some point during the day. But there's a transgender girl at a school in the Jordan School District, an elementary school, and says she isn't welcome in the girls' bathroom, and she's not welcome in the boys' bathroom. Here's what she told the school board last night.
I just want the space and acceptance to be me.
It's tough. This is a very, very difficult situation because somebody's going to be uncomfortable. The transgender child's going to feel uncomfortable in one bathroom. But again, as a biological male, going into a women's bathroom or a girl's bathroom, it's entirely possible that the girls in that bathroom would be uncomfortable with her presence. So somebody's going to feel uncomfortable. What is the solution? Well, in my mind, I think, why have we designed restrooms and bathrooms the way we have?
With no privacy?
There is no privacy.
Yeah. So you bring that up. That's a great point. I think we've redesigned the phone and no longer hangs on the wall. We carry around in our pockets, you know. We've redesigned cars. But, you know, why are bathrooms like from the Stone Ages?
Bathrooms, locker rooms.
You went to a bathroom, you said, in an airport in Kansas
yeah.
City. And what was that? You said it was just different.
They called it a mixed gender bathroom. So men and women both go into the same bathroom. And at first I thought I was seeing this wrong. I've never seen anything like this before. So anyway, my brother and I, we were traveling and we stop off. We go in and they had redesigned it completely. So the only common area was the sink. And then you had rows of stalls, floor to ceiling, individual closets that everyone would go in, complete and total privacy. And although it was something I'd never experienced before, it was a little weird just because it was new. It was great. It was fine. I felt completely comfortable. It was total privacy. Mm. It was great. And I thought, why in the world don't we have all bathrooms designed that way? It doesn't take up any more space. And that I want to clarify. You're already using the space. Just redesign it a little bit.
Yeah, these stalls that they have now, it's just like there's like 4 feet of space off on the top, and there's three feet of space on the bottom. And sometimes they're so rickety. I was in one the other night, and I looked down, and it's like this thing's all crooked. Anyway, we're off. You're right, Dave. I think that's a great point. And you know, Allison's dad spoke out at the board meeting as well. Now, remember, Allison was born a biological male, identifies as a girl, wants to use the school bathroom at the elementary school she attends in the Jordan District. Here's what Dad said.
She goes into the boys' restroom. She's not accepted there. She goes into the girls' restroom. She's not accepted there. It's so silly.
Now, there's another side of this, and you've eloquently pointed this out, and Natalie Klein at the state school board was there. She said, I'm not here as a school board member. I'm here as, you know, somebody who was elected representing people in this district, basically, in a nutshell, that's what she said. She took the side of the biological girls at the school.
Forces girls who are not comfortable sharing their bathroom with boys to feel like they are somehow wrong or guilty for feeling this way.
Greg Skordis joins us right now from the KSL. He's our KSL legal analyst. And Greg, what does the federal law, what does the state law say, and what does it tell districts, or does it even tell districts how to handle this?
Yeah. Unfortunately, it doesn't tell them much, Dave, except that Title IX just says you can't discriminate. And it's a solution, but doesn't really solve the problem, or at least it's trying to do that. But what we've seen a lot in, because what you're talking about would be incredibly expensive to retrofit all the bathrooms so that they have this floor-to-ceiling closet.
True.
It would be ideal. It would be great. True. But what you see more and more lately that does accommodate the law is just a designated bathroom for anyone, usually a small one. And if you have an elementary school and you have, let's say, 15, 20 bathrooms, maybe you have one that is private for anyone to go into. And so this child could go into that, and any other child could, without fear of sort of level of embarrassment. I think that's the future, and I think that's what schools are going to be doing going forward, rather than the sort of the expensive argument that you made about the Kansas City bathroom, or at least the example you made.
Yeah.
But I think that's the way of the future that would comply with Title IX.
Yeah, I think a new construction, it could certainly be considered, I would hope. But yeah, because these other bathrooms are just so outdated anyway. But the Jordan District did put out a statement, Greg. And you mentioned Title IX, and that's what they cited in their statement about this. And we don't know what the Jordan District will or the school board will ultimately do, if anything, about this. I know they took public comment last night, but here's the statement. The Jordan District follows Title IX federal law banning sex discrimination and harassment related to gender identity in schools. So does that cover the Jordan District then? Are they using that as a way to say, look, a child can use any bathroom they want to?
Well, it doesn't cover them at all. I appreciate the statement, hey, we're not violating the law. But in this particular instance, they're not complying with the law either. And I'm not saying they're violating it. But this particular student, from what you just read about Title IX, Debbie, you articulated it perfectly. They can't discriminate. And it appears that they're doing that because this child has no bathroom to go to. And so, like I said, you know, create a specific one that would comply with Title IX, that would allow the student to use it, and other students who identify as transgender or just are not offended by walking into a bathroom where there's one person or another.
But I just want to point something out, Greg. I'm not 100% sure that I know the layout of that school in particular, that there isn't a private bathroom that this child could use. See what I'm going on there? Okay. All right. And just pointing
that
out.
And if there is, problem solved. Absolutely. But I don't think they would have had this conversation, Debbie, yesterday, had that been the case. But you're right. That solves everything, or at least it solves it, at least on a temporary basis. And then, like you guys are talking about, going forward, when we're building schools, we need to take into account this particular problem that's going to continue to come up more and more and more. And federal law protects these students and tries to do everything it can to make sure that they're treated equally and without harassment or embarrassment or any other problems.
Greg, my understanding, though, is that when we say they don't have a bathroom, they do have a bathroom available to them. It's just the one, as whatever their biological sex was at birth, that's the bathroom that they're, even though they may not feel comfortable there, that is the bathroom that is designated for them, correct?
It is, but Title IX goes a little further, and what you just said is perfect. They may not feel comfortable there. Title IX requires that there be that the student not be placed in that situation, that they not be made to feel uncomfortable or discriminated against. I mean, we do need to make some reasonable accommodations, and what that is for Jordan District and what that is for other schools remains to be seen. But if the student is uncomfortable or feels threatened or just like even just the uncomfortable all by itself, the school should make and almost has to make under Title IX of federal law some reasonable accommodations. And I know that offends a lot of people and really troubles a lot of people, but it's the way we are right now in this country.
Are there accommodations made for those who would feel uncomfortable if a trans kid came into their bathroom? Or is there comfortability or...
No, that's a great question because it applies to everyone. It applies to everyone. So you may have students, some of these parents that spoke, that have students who are female and saying, look, I'm not comfortable with this child coming into my bathroom either. So the school's got to accommodate everyone. And that's why there has to be a third, I think, level of bathroom or you know, accommodation for that, so that nobody's uncomfortable going into that particular bathroom.
Greg Skordas, thank you for joining us, KSL legal analyst. A very, very tricky situation and heartbreaking. You know, this is not something, it's one of the most private times of our lives. We don't want to share it with other people naturally. And this is a struggle that you have to battle this out in you know, school board meetings.
Next, there was a massive looting event that happened in Philadelphia last night. And what comes to mind here is that these were kids. That's what stood out to me. It seems like most of them were youth. Some of them were masked. They busted into like stores like Lululemon and the Apple Store. I mean, here's one video clip I found on X.
I got a little backstory on this sound. You're going to love it, of who this person is. It was an influencer. Debbie, I'll tell you about her coming up.
Dave and Dejanovic.
An 8-hour crime spree in Philadelphia. Screaming free iPhones. It started about 8 o'clock last night. Things finally wrapped up about 4 a.m. Only 20 looters, up to 20 looters or so, were arrested. Most of them, I think, were kids.
Yeah, can you believe that? An 8-hour looting spree. And part of the reason we're talking about this, and I think the real hook here, Deb, is we've learned that Target is closing 9 stores. Mm-hmm. Around the country because of organized retail theft and safety for their employees and customers. There's so much crime going on here. They are shutting down Target. This is an enormous business that brings millions of dollars into the community and serves that they serve. And they're shutting it down because of all the theft.
And employees are probably, I don't know if they're going to be sent to other stores to work or not, but this is not the first time. This isn't our first rodeo talking about this. We've talked about looting in California and San Francisco and Los Angeles, but then there's this. I was scrolling through X, formerly known as Twitter, this morning, and I found this video
outside. Free iPhones.
And I showed it to you this morning and, you know, you're like, that lady's yelling free iPhones. And then we look at the video and you see people walking out with fistfuls of iPhones.
Yeah. Yeah. Fistfuls of iPhones. Well, I just learned, Debbie, that the free iPhone lady.
Okay.
She's a very popular influencer, social media influencer in Philadelphia. She was live streaming this to 650,000 of her followers. Her name is Meatball. She's live streaming the event, and she was encouraging everybody to keep going. She's laughing maniacally. It was quite the scene.
That's wild. So sort of feeding the fury.
Yes.
If you will. And the video is just wild. I mean, so they've got all these people running into different stores. I think it was a Apple Store, Lululemon Store.
Foot Locker.
A lot of which is just grabbing massive amounts of clothing out of Foot Locker. Looks like they were shoving some of them in trunks, some of the clothes in trunks of cars. So there's this protest that happened in the area just before the looting spree happened, the 8-hour looting spree happened. And the chief of police, I don't want to call him the commissioner or something there, he made it clear. He held a news conference. He said these two incidents are not related.
Again, I just wanted to reiterate that this had nothing to do with the protest. What we had tonight was a bunch of criminal opportunists take advantage of a situation and make an attempt to destroy our city.
Okay, that's what the police are saying, but Meatball disagreed. That's Meatball live streaming the event, maniacally laughing. And she said, the reason this is happening is because this is what happens when we don't get justice in this city. Now, what she's talking about in the protest that you referenced, Debbie, was a police officer. Charges had been dropped. He'd been involved in a shooting of a man. And anyway, the judge dropped those. So there was a protest that was already happening. The cops say this had nothing to do with it, though Meatball was saying, yeah, this is what happens. Now, this video, Debbie, where she's maniacally laughing is where cops are body slamming looters to the ground and arresting them. And she is maniacally laughing as this is going on.
I'm just thinking of the couple that I read about in one of the articles I was reading this morning, who's sitting eating dinner outside, and then a big loot fest breaks out. I mean, I just thinking about how that the mob scene, people running out of stores with stuff that is just worth thousands and thousands of dollars. I mean, I don't even know what the cost of a new iPhone is. I'm going to guess about $1,200, $1,400, running out with these fistfuls of iPhones. Just scary. I wouldn't even... I don't know. And then I think about the people that were might have been shopping in those stores. And I think, would you ever want to go back? What if I was in one of those stores? I was just in a couple of stores with my, both of my daughters last weekend. And we were just shopping, having a great mom-daughter stay out. And I can't imagine. Didn't happen. You know, hopefully it never happens. But you're sitting in that, you're sitting in the store waiting for your child to come out of the dressing room or something like that. And all of a sudden... all these people bust in, and these were stores that are frequented, like Foot Locker, Lululemon, and Apple Store. What do you think this spells?
The death of brick and mortar stores.
Really? That's strong.
I absolutely think the way we have changed over the last several years, ordering online, having everything delivered, that will be the standard because, and I think it will actually be a good thing. Because right now I think we are shopping largely because we enjoy it. We like the convenience. But we all know how to shop online. And sometimes we do a little and sometimes we do it a lot. Whether I order groceries online and then I just pick them up.
But see, I think I look at it a little differently. I look at it, shopping as like an experience. You know, and I don't know if I have that same experience on scrolling Amazon as I do, you know, just kind of leisurely strolling through a mall to go, you know, grab maybe a couple things with my kids. Of course, they're all adults now. And sometimes I just go there because it's like a really, it's a wintry day in Utah in December and I want to go walk around. So I go, you know, I go to the mall. But I will say, Dave, I think that shoplifting has changed behaviors of stores where they are locking things up more and more. The more pricier items are difficult to look at and get to and see. And I've noticed in my own neighborhood where one of the stores, the big box stores I go to, has locked up some items. Now I understand why. They got to protect the items and they got to put people at the front door to check receipts. I get all that. I'm happy to show them my receipt. But I found myself driving 10 minutes in the other direction to the same store up the road where I could just drive down the store 3 or 4 minutes to that other store. And because they don't lock things up at this other store that's farther away. But it just feels like a better shopping experience.
Yeah,
for
no question. Yeah, the convenience of not having to find somebody to get a razor, you know, or get some Sudafed that might be locked up. Absolutely the experience. But the experience is being ruined right now several ways. Number one, the safety. As you said, we haven't experienced it. We've never seen one of these big looting experiences while we've been there. But I would feel so violated. I'd feel in danger if this would happen. And then also think of how much money we're having to pay. Because the stores obviously have to jack up prices to offset everything that is being stolen. So if we get rid of the brick and mortars, the prices are going to come down because they're not dealing with thousands and hundreds and millions and billions of dollars of theft.
You think prices will drop?
Because
of the theft is that overwhelming.
Well, think of as you're watching this in Philadelphia, how many millions and millions and millions of dollars was stolen?
Yeah. Well, they made some arrests. But
15 to 20?
I don't know if they're going to get all the merchandise back. Next, let's talk about the second presidential debate for the GOP candidates. And I was shocked when I found out they only bounced one guy. So what are they, down to 9? No, 7. I don't know. There's going to be too many on stage tonight. Let's talk to Justin Finch in Washington, D.C. about it next.
Race for the White House. Special coverage on KSL News Radio.
It feels like Republicans are ruining the political season a lot, much like the way retailers ruin the holiday season by putting out Christmas stuff in September.
I love this comparison. This is so true. I mean, this is basically, you know how people get so angry about Halloween stuff coming out. Yeah, in July.
Literally, July.
Now, this is basically July of the year before Halloween happens. It's like celebrating, you know, bringing out the Halloween stuff in December. Like, it just doesn't make any sense. Way too early.
And Dave and I talking about the second Republican debate that's scheduled for tonight. And it looks like, I mean, I don't want this to be a spoiler alert for y'all, because I know you're like, oh my gosh, scuttle dinner plans tonight, honey. We have got to be online trying to search around to see where we can watch this thing. I mean, I had a wild time last time trying to figure out how I could watch it. I had to subscribe and all that other stuff. But this looks like it might be almost identical to the last debate, except for they kicked one of the debaters off the stage. Well, actually, they didn't kick him off the stage. They're not going to allow him on the stage. Asa Hutchinson did not qualify.
Yeah, still no Trump. Mm-hmm. But Trump is so far ahead of the competition in the polls. He's just not bothering with the debates right now. And if I'm being honest, I like it. I like it because when Trump is on the stage, it is all about Trump, 100%. When he's not there, and we saw this in the first debate, the other candidates are able to talk about other things. It doesn't revolve around January 6th and the election. No, they could actually talk about stuff and we'll learn something.
Well, you bring up a good point. Trump, we know what he's about, right? We know what his politics are. We know what he was like as president. Give these other candidates a chance at their 5 minutes of fame on stage so we can hear what they stand for or what they don't stand for. So where's Trump? We were talking about this yesterday when President Joe Biden flew into Michigan to stand in solidarity, even if it was just for a few minutes, with the United Auto Workers who are on strike in Michigan. He stood in the picket line. I don't know if it was just a social media moment or it really made a difference. Well, Trump will be counter-programming tonight's debate once again. Yeah, like he did with the first Republican debate with Tucker Carlson when he interviewed him, Trump on X, which is a pre-recorded interview that aired on that social media platform. Had hundreds of millions of views, so what's Trump going to be up to?
Yeah, okay, now I will say those numbers a little inflated, by the way. A view gets counted if you watch at least 2 seconds of the video. So
that's good to know.
But still, millions of times, it had a lot of reach, no doubt.
So where's Trump? He's spending the day in Michigan. He's copycatting President Biden, or President Biden try to leapfrog former President Trump. Anyway, he's in Michigan at a rally while Justin Finch is standing by for us at ABC News. So no Trump, huh?
Surprise, surprise. Former President Donald Trump will not be at tonight's debate at the Reagan Library in California. It will be interesting to see, though, just how this counter-programming plan comes together. Where will it be streamed? You know, how will it be engaged with? That remains to be seen. But as you mentioned, seven hopefuls on the stage tonight: Ron DeSantis, Nikki Haley, Tim Scott, Vivek Ramaswamy, Mike Pence, Chris Christie, and Doug Burgum. And as you mentioned, it was a bit tighter to qualify for this debate. You had to show sufficient poll support and have at least 50,000 unique donors. Those are just some of the qualifications there. What we're watching for tonight, which is in the absence of Donald Trump physically being on that stage, can Haley and Ramaswamy leverage their breakout success in debate one, going into debate two, through that debate, and on from here? Also, can DeSantis and Scott kind of wrangle some of that attention away from those two? And also, how will the stage react to the events of the day? Among the most pressing, the shutdown reaction. You know, Nikki Haley went on the record to say that she believes that Congress should not get paid if other government workers are not getting paid during a shutdown. Also, how will they respond to Ukraine, now a critical wedge in funding for the government as well? Trump, as you mentioned, will be in Detroit speaking with those UAW workers. They're on the scene. Interestingly enough, Mike Pence telling ABC News that he believes that Trump should be on the debate stage with them, defending his presidency in 2016, and adding, too, that he believes that the Trump today is not the same Trump that he knew back in 2016. Asa Hutchinson will be in Michigan, too. There is a spoiler, more or less, aiming to debunk what he says are the false promises that Trump has made over the years to blue-collar and union workers. So quite the night is stacking up already.
Justin Finch with ABC News is joining us as we discuss the preview of the second GOP debate. Will there be any substantial changes to the format of the debate, or is this going to be largely what we expect?
It's expected that this will be a pro forma debate in many ways. But once we get to debate three is when things are set to really get interesting. There are already whispers Trump won't be there for that either. But the stage is set to get even smaller, and which focuses more attention on each of the speakers. The smaller that stage gets, the more time each has to speak. And then with that, we are more lended to see changes in format, perhaps more time to respond, and even more time for some to pounce on the others. So it's going to get harder in more ways than one, even with Trump not being there. At some point, he may show up, but even when he is not, he is certainly there in the room in many ways.
Justin Finch, thank you for joining us with the preview, ABC News correspondent.
I'll be curious. I'll be watching very closely Nikki Haley. I thought she did very well at the last debate. I'll see how she responds tonight to some of the questions. I was going to say performs. It was a little bit performative in some ways because they're very well rehearsed, all of the candidates. Vivek Ramaswamy, I haven't heard too much from him on the campaign trail, but I mean, it just could be because I'm suffering from a political season burnout and haven't been paying as close attention to him. But also Ron DeSantis feels like he has just kind of become somewhat sidelined over the last couple of weeks since the last debate, that his numbers were beginning to drop. I don't exactly know where they are right now.
They're at about 15%. So they stabilized and even took a little bit of we've seen a little bit of an uptick over the last few weeks.
Okay. So all eyes in Simi Valley, California tonight, right? Except for maybe not all eyes. Lots of eyes.
It will be. Another thing about Trump is, as he's meeting in Michigan, he's meeting with non-union workers at an auto parts plant, and we expect to hear him talking to them about the move toward electric vehicles, the Biden administration's push, and we'll speak to some of the fears that these workers have about the future of their jobs and if they'll be replaced with the changeover into electric vehicles.
Next, more than half of Americans feel like we're behind on our retirement savings. Then I took a look at the number, the amount of money that we need to have in a savings account before we retire. And I'm like, what? That's next. Right.
2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
She was tear-gassed and beaten.
Images of thousands desperate to escape Taliban oppression filled our news feeds. More than 80,000 Afghans made it to America. But the story didn't end there.
It was very cold. There was no power, no heat.
Who would help our newest neighbors? I'm Andrea Smartin. In Stranger Becomes Neighbor, you'll hear the stories of some remarkable refugees who left their homes and their dreams behind, only to start over from zero.
Their only possession was three blankets.
And you'll meet Americans who stepped up to help them.
You want me to come when you deliver your baby.
What can one person do in the face of an international disaster decades in the making? That's Stranger Becomes Neighbor. Find us at kslpodcast.com. Follow us on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else you listen.
On the Money, special coverage with Dave and Dejanovic.
There's a new survey out. We're going to talk about it right now because it just speaks to all of us about retirement. We're nervous about it because we don't feel like we have enough money to retire. In fact, Bankrate found that 56% of American workers say they feel behind on retirement savings. And I think this is why we feel behind, is because we also feel, according to these numbers, Dave, that we need $1 million in a savings account to retire comfortably.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things that are going on. Number one, to your point, $1 million seems unattainable. But part of the reason it feels unattainable is because we don't really understand compounding interest. That the money we save in our 20s, 30s, 40s, well, by the time we're in our late 60s, those last several years, maybe that last decade, we see incredible growth for all the years that we sacrificed and saved up. So we don't see the huge changes because, again, compounding interest really rewards the tail end of your savings plan. That still is overwhelming. And we don't understand, okay, what does $1 million mean in 20 years
when I retire? Right. I mean, you look at how inflation has jarred families in Utah, across the country, of course. In just the last couple of years, nobody saw this coming. Nobody predicted a pandemic would hit and supplies would be short. We'd be paying all kinds of money for toilet paper and, you know, and also a lot of people lost their jobs. And so they suffered a financial setback there. So I think it's, of course, anytime we have anxiety over anything, it's because there's a fear of the unknown. I mean, that is the definition of anxiety, and why it hits us is we don't know what's happening. So we try to plan for the best case scenario, but I still think that $1 million, seven figures in a savings account does feel overwhelming when there's so many other. We just got done talking about the cost of childcare and how that might be going up because of cuts in federal funding to childcare centers. And so this is overwhelming cycle that I can see where this anxiety sets in, and then you just get overwhelmed.
Bankrate has done some great research on this. Senior economic analyst Mark Hamrick joins us right now. Mark, what age group is feeling most vulnerable right now?
Yeah, good to be with you, Dave and Debbie. I think there's a sense of reality setting in for more senior workers who say they feel more behind than their younger counterparts. And I do want to address the issue that you're talking about, sense of the unknown and uncertainty. This is one of the reasons why we do this survey, is to highlight the risk that people do feel as if they're making a mistake or have essentially failed to prioritize their retirement savings. And so the best opportunity, your point about compounding interest is well taken. Those who are youngest are in the best position to take advantage of that. Some of us are old enough to remember there was a time when the Dow Jones Industrials average was below 1,000, and more recently having been above 35,000. So that is a real thing.
Yeah.
And doing nothing is not a good alternative. Right. And so take advantage of those employer matches for those people who have the 401ks. And if you don't have that, there are other ways to go about it.
So let's, if you have some solutions, I would love to hear them, because we don't want to leave people with a sinking feeling that you got to get to $1 million. I do feel like $1 million is a lofty goal. What if it were more like in the $600,000 range? If, for example, you're maybe leaning on some Social Security, which I know have some question marks regarding how much of that will be available. Maybe you have a little pension that'll help subsidize that, or maybe you can rent space in your basement, those kinds of things. I mean, can you lower that number and make it feel more realistic? And then what are some of your other solutions?
Well, I guess I'd take issue, Debbie, with the notion that it's not attainable. Everything in America, reasonably speaking, is attainable if we make it a priority. That's
sure.
That's the tale of success of our country and the people who populate it. But to your point, to make it more manageable, it is to start, right? And to start as early as possible. We all need to essentially chew gum and walk at the same time, meaning we have to pay down our debt if we have it, or pay it off if it's credit card debt, because it's essentially historically high right now. We need to prioritize emergency savings. And the people who live beneath their means now are in the best position to retire well. And those who are sort of living the fear of missing out lifestyle are going to be the ones who are more likely to be missing out on their retirement. So the point is to start, for those who are youngest, to start ASAP, and to have a budget. And by the way, look at Bankrate.com, which is a free and trusted source of good information on this topic, including our retirement calculators, which you can look at online and just get an idea about what's attainable, perhaps with the income you have right now. But also for those younger workers, you know, the income that you think is reasonable that you might have 10, 20, 30 years down the road if things proceed even close to what we expect they may do.
one thing I think I stole from my dad. I'll attribute it to him, but he said, you're always going to have debt. You have to be able to save and pay down debt throughout your entire life. Mm-hmm. Because there is a temptation when you have debt. It's like, I'm just going to throw everything toward debt, which does seem kind of never ending in our lives.
Well, it really depends on the highest cost debt that we have, right? And so even student loan debt, which is sort of a political lightning rod these days, that's lower cost debt, typically speaking. So would be at least a mortgage before we got into the 7% realm of a 30-year fix. But you know what? That is historically the average. People like me were taking on double-digit percentage mortgage rates a few decades ago and understood that that is an affordability issue right now. So I would say prioritize the highest cost debt, meaning that which is the most costly in terms of a annual percentage rate, and to use debt as a tool. And like a good tool, like a hammer, you can build a house with it, or you can, you know, hit your thumb with it, and we'll hope that you can build rather than do damage.
Mark, before we let you go, and by the way, Mark Hamrick is with Bankrate. He's a senior economic analyst with the organization, and we're talking to him about the fact that their survey found that most Americans feel like they're behind on their retirement savings, and they feel like they got to get to about $1 million in a savings account to retire comfortably. It sounds like you're really pushing us and strongly suggesting that we start with that debt, and in particular credit card debt, get that paid off, and then perhaps be able to put more money in savings because we're not paying the interest and we're not paying on those credit card bills.
Well, I would say this is the only way that essentially you can get a 20 to 30% return on your money. It's not really a return in the investment sense, but to pay that off ASAP. But I would say you really need to do all these things at once to some degree. And I just want to differentiate. I wouldn't necessarily call it a savings account per se, but rather I would put the focus more on an investment account where you have a diversified portfolio that includes some exposure to equities, which over the long term do perform well. That could be mutual funds, exchange-traded funds, and some mixture of fixed income right now because we're seeing some of the best returns on things like bonds, and CDs, et cetera, the best returns we've seen there in many, many years. So it is not all bleak because of a rising and high interest rate environment. We're actually seeing some returns on savings of the more conservative kind that is really more of a realignment with historical norms, having been through this record low interest rate period, really going back to the great financial crisis.
Senior economic analyst Mark Hamrick, thank you for joining us from Bankrate.
I was reviewing credit card interest rates the other night online, just for a project that I'm working on here at Broadcast House, and 21%.
On average?
Right? Yeah, 21%, up to 30%, 29%, 30%. It's not out of the ordinary. And so if you had, you know, $1,000 or $2,000 on a credit card at 21% interest, it's just like that interest is just, I used to say, it's like throwing it out the window, that money out the window as you're driving down the freeway because it's just evaporating. It's going into the bank's pockets or whatever. I would just work like crazy to get rid of that if that were hanging over my head and pay that off while saving. I understand that, but I think you could turn around and put some of that money into a savings account.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you this. I'm so glad I've never taken the full advantage of my 401k, where 5% of my paycheck goes in, it gets matched at 4%. Sure, I could have used that 5% and helped pay down some credit card debt, but I would have missed out on some huge gains.
That's why it's important to follow your dad's advice to do both, right?
Save and pay down debt.
Yeah, save and get rid of those credit cards if both are possible. Wow, thanks so much. That was great. Great to kind of give some solutions to a looming problem. We're back in just a second. We're going to speak with the Deseret News opinion editor, Jay Evenson. He's going to talk to us about the government shutdown. I heard they made some progress on it. Maybe the place won't shut down. We'll find out next.
David Dujanovic, special coverage of the top national story.
We are heading toward a government shutdown, it would appear. We don't know if it's going to happen, but the deadline is looming. It's this weekend for Congress to work out a deal, even if it's a short-term deal. We're going to talk to Jay Evenson of the Deseret News in just a moment about his take on what, if anything, we'll notice if the government does shut down.
I chuckle a little bit because we know this date's coming. It doesn't change. It is September 30th every single year. And we procrastinate and we push it to the end and then we panic and then something eventually gets done. Why do we get sucked into this every single time?
Jay, do you feel like something is going to get done?
Yes.
Can we get his microphone on there, Don? Thank you.
Hi,
Jay.
Yes, I feel something eventually is going to get done, but I also feel like we're going to have a shutdown.
You do.
There's so much left to be done by Saturday night. I don't know. And I know the Senate has a proposal now that they've passed. But there's some non-starters there for certain members of the Republican Party in the House, such as funding for Ukraine. And they're digging their heels in. Maybe that will change before Saturday night, but so far it hasn't.
You only need 60 senators, so you only need a few, right?
Yeah, well, I think the problem's not in the Senate, but it's in the House. And, of course, under these new rules, any one member of the House can call for a vote to oust the Speaker of the House. And so he's worried about caving in too much to what the Democrats want because he's worried about holding his office. So,
but it would be very easy. They could call for it. The Freedom Caucus could absolutely call for a vote of no confidence, whatever the official name is, to oust Speaker McCarthy. All the Democrats have to do is rally around him, vote him in, and you move this through. Boyd Matheson always talks about the fake fight, and it feels like, again, this is the very definition of the fake fight. We could get it done, and all the threats of these small fringe groups, they could be ignored almost as an afterthought if everyone would just get on the same page and work together for 5 minutes.
Yeah. You know, these are the pressure points in politics, right? The debt ceiling and the budget. And if you're a minority and you want to press your point, you use this threat of a shutdown in order to do so. And it usually revolves around overspending, government overspending. Well, you look back over the last 10 years, we've had the fiscal cliff. We've had sequestration. We've shut the government down 3 times, and yet we're still spending money like crazy. I write about this in my column. It was 2012 when I wrote about it, and I was so concerned. And we had a $16 trillion debt. And now we just passed $33 trillion.
In 2012?
In 2012, it was $16 trillion.
So just 11 years ago.
Right. We've more than doubled. And
approaching
so,
a triple.
Right. But my point is this brinkmanship strategy doesn't work. If you're really serious about cutting government spending, it takes hard work. And it takes hard work behind the scenes, and it takes using your political capital to try to get something done. But this is just performance. It's not really serious. It's not really getting anything done.
Jay, you were saying that to a lot of people, this has become noise. They don't even realize that this is potentially going to be happening this weekend. It could happen Saturday night if they don't strike a deal. Mm-hmm. By Sunday, we could have the government shut down. You're like, well, what's it going? Well, people are flying.
Yes.
Right. We don't know yet how this is going to impact, for example, TSA.
Right.
Maybe you're going to show up Monday morning to a national park. I know the Utah legislature said they're going to continue to look at ways to fund our national parks, but I don't know what other states are doing. You don't know how that's going to impact a national park. What are the other consequences? I see the title of your opinion piece is what are the consequences of a government shutdown? What are the other consequences that you're seeing?
Well, there are things like inspection of food and that type of thing. There's a lot of things that the government does that you just kind of take for granted and don't even think about. And, of course, you're going to see hundreds of thousands of federal workers furloughed. And you're going to see cutbacks in certain welfare-type benefits and programs that the government administers. The average person probably won't feel it much at all, actually. And we were joking before, I'm actually flying Sunday morning, and so I don't know what TSA is going to be like. They are considered essential, so they are supposed to come to work. A lot of them tend to call in sick when this happens because they're not going to be paid. They're going to be paid retroactively once this ends, but there's not a
which
lot of
which they always have been.
Yes.
Never once have they not paid these workers.
Right.
It's just a delay, whatever the week or two, or the longest ever was 32 days, I believe. Yeah. So, I mean, eventually they get paid.
Yeah. And opinion polls have shown that a lot of Americans don't even know this is happening, or perhaps don't even care. And it probably isn't going to affect them that much. But what is going to affect them is this overspending and the $33 trillion debt. Once it gets to a point where it starts hurting U.S. bonds and people start having to inflate the currency in order to pay off debt, then we'll feel. But no one knows when that's going to happen. We don't know when we cross that red line.
I think part of the argument here, and you say it doesn't work, that we still have just skyrocketed and the debt has ballooned in just the last 10 years. I didn't realize it had nearly tripled, or whatever, 11 years or so. It's nearly tripled. That is an incredible number. But I would almost argue that the reason that we're here, obviously, is through the cooperation. Because nobody has stood their ground and said, we have to have monumental changes. Because what happens is they both yell at each other, they both come together, and they pass a budget, or they change something that has outrageous deficit spending. I think there's an argument to be made we haven't felt the pain enough, that no one has stood on principle, and that everyone caves, which has led us to nearly tripling the debt in the last decade.
Well, this is a political process. And so the minute the government shuts down, everyone starts watching the polls. Who's being blamed for it? And the party that's being blamed for it is going to probably blink first and give in. But let's be serious. We're just talking about penny-ante stuff. This is discretionary spending. If you really want to fix the deficit and debt problem, you have to reform Social Security. You have to reform Medicare. That's really difficult, and it's going to cost some people their jobs in Congress to do what has to be done.
Wow. Yeah.
That's two-thirds of the debt. Yeah. The discretionary spending is just a third of the
debt. Yes.
I mean, you bring it home there, Jay, at the end. I mean, that has to be dealt with, and yet I don't see anybody back in D.C. really taking that football and wanting to run across the goal line with it.
Well, we all remember President Biden's State of the Union address, where he accused Republicans of wanting to kill Social Security, and they yelled and screamed, no, we're not. And we basically came to an agreement there that, okay, that's going to be off the table. Well,
yeah.
Okay, what do you do when it runs out of money?
Then it's back on the table.
Right, quickly.
Jay Evenson, thank you for joining us. You can read Jay's work on the Deseret at Deseret.com. The opinion section. There are lots of great stuff from Jay. Thanks for joining us.
Dave and DeGenevic.
So yesterday we talked about Utah ranking 8th for the highest divorce rate. We're like in pretty good company with our friends in Idaho. I don't know why, what the differences are, but or similarities are there. But we are kind of all in that same category that. Yeah, we tend to go to the divorce court a lot more than I would have expected. But remember, I told after the show, Dave, yesterday, I said I feel badly that all we did was focus on like divorce. I'm like, there are ways to save a marriage when we talk about that, like make a marriage last for a long time. I mean, you might be the expert at that. You've been married forever.
Well, yeah, 24 years. That's a good chunk. I think when we talk about, you know, what makes it work? What's difficult is there's so many different ways to make it work. But I think there are some fundamental things that I've learned over the years that I apply, and it is we change, and there are a lot of changes. So the person my wife married right now, you know, back when we were in our early 20s, is not the person who I am now in my mid 40s. And she's not the same person. We have been changed by our children. And we have had to learn to adapt and change and learn to re-love each other or love the different versions of each other as the years have gone on.
We posted this question yesterday, I think it was yesterday, to our KSL News Radio. I also posted it to my KSL Facebook pages. So this question lives, you know, has lived for about 24 hours on both of my page and also KSL News Radio's Facebook page. Because I thought, you know, we need to ask, what is this, your secret to a happy, you know, marriage that sticks, you know, a marriage that sticks? Because we heard from, he's a senator, Todd Weiler on Capitol Hill, but he's also a divorce attorney. Or he's an attorney. He does a lot of things. He messaged me yesterday. He's like, you know, I do things besides help people file for divorce. But anyways, case in point, we had him on the show yesterday about what he sees, like what the reasons he sees for divorce when people come to him.
It's almost never one reason, but if I had to pick one reason, I would say unrealistic expectations. So a lot of people think if I get divorced, it's all my problems are going to go away and I'm just going to live happily ever after. And that almost never happens. In fact, usually your problems may multiply because now you have two families to deal with instead of one. And, a lot of people, and, you know, get married and have those expectations. And two years later, they have some debt. They have a crying baby. And, you know, that little spark of all of those hormones that kind of led you to the marriage, you know, that's kind of run out. So and then I think that's when people have to make the choice. Are we in this together or are we going to, you know, part our ways?
And that idea that problems multiply 100%. I mean, when I got married at 24 years old, we just had ourselves to take care of. We would live on a shoestring. We were both super healthy. And then you have a child. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, you know, you might have some unexpected medical bills.
Right.
Or, yeah, things start to multiply.
Life.
Yeah.
Life
Which
happens.
Is totally normal.
Yeah. But then that's when you see what your marriage is made of, is when life starts coming at you and things you hadn't anticipated start happening. And maybe you hit a financial hiccup. You got to, you know, maybe you figure out that your partner you thought was so amazing on that first date spends way too much money and you're a saver and all these other issues that can happen. I want to focus on the positive here. Like, what are the things that keep a marriage together? Because I clearly don't have that answer. Right? Hint, hint. I don't have that answer. So let's turn to Facebook. And then I want to hear what you think, Dave, from these responses that we got from our listeners. Wow, we had a lot of people wanting to give their advice on this, and I love it. Tanya says communication and having time together is important.
Yeah, that's crucial. When I grew up, my mom and dad, I never saw them once on a Friday night. Like, not once were they around. And that's something I stole that. I stole that idea. And yeah, Friday night,
Friday night?
We're out.
Okay, that's awesome. Yeah. And then Randy said, yeah, go on a date every week. I wholeheartedly agree that could be a marriage saver. That's not what we did. We did not go on a date every weekend. And that breaks my heart. And I'm glad when couples go out on dates, when I see couples together and I'm dining alone at the local Texas Roadhouse, you know where I am. I'm totally like, just, you know, don't feel bad for me. I'm good. But I look at them and I'm thinking, that is how it's done. That has got to be one of the many ingredients to a happy, long marriage.
And can I say something about the date night?
Yeah.
This is going to sound terrible, but I'm going to say it anyways. It's inconvenient. It's not easy to set
what you're saying.
Does that sound mean?
No.
That sounds terrible.
No, I know. You're like, oh, it's so easy to say, let's not.
Yes.
It's so much easier to be like, it's been a rough week. Let's just stay in. Like, the babysitter issues are coming up. I can't find a babysitter for tonight. If you need a babysitter or whatever, I don't want to leave the kids home alone to, you know, run the farm.
We don't have any money.
We don't have any money.
We're broke.
You could do things for free. That's what always bugged me. It's like, there's so many things you can do for free. You don't need to use money as an excuse for everything.
Worth it.
Lisa says, go walking together every day. I see couples walking together every day. I'm walking alone. I'm painting a really lonely picture. I don't mind it actually being by myself at all. And just because you're alone, I want to make it clear, does not mean you're lonely. But I love when I see couples walking together. Sometimes I wonder why some couples are holding hands. Maybe they're just started dating and others seem to be walking like 2 feet apart, you know, and in silence. I saw a couple the other day walking along, Dave, and they were walking in silence and they were probably my age, in their 50s. I thought, if I was walking with my man, there's no way I would be quiet. I'd be tucking your ear off. Laughter. Tempe says laughter, communication, flirting with each other.
Yeah, that keep the spark alive. It's so easy to let everything get in the way, you know, of the romance, especially the longer you're together. It's very easy to let some very good things, you know, running kids around, getting them involved, working on projects, home repair, whatever it might be. There's a lot of things, good things that we can be doing. And we do forget some of the courting behavior, the flirting and the romance and the candlelight dinners.
So Kels says, and by the way, if you're just joining us and wondering why we've turned this into like a marriage therapy session here on the Still News Radio, is because there is a problem in Utah, and it is our high divorce rate. We talked about that yesterday in depth, and I felt badly that that's all we focused on. We didn't focus on ways to keep a marriage together. We really couldn't think of a better way to help, you know, I don't know, share ideas than to turn to our Facebook family. So we're reading through our posts on KSL News Radio's Facebook page right now. What do you think about this? Kels says separate finances has kept their marriage together.
Separate finances?
Yeah.
Boy, that just seems so impractical.
I tried it. I tried it. It's tricky. Because then it got into, and maybe people are more graceful about it than I am, but it almost was like, well, did you pay the light bill? Because I don't want to have to pay the light bill. And we would separate it out, but then it just got kind of messy. I kind of looked at it as this has to be run somewhat like a very efficient business, our finances.
You don't have two CFOs. And never the twain shall meet.
It's so true. It just got messy. And I'm like, let me just deal with it. I'll just deal with it. But again, I mean, I don't know. I'm not the expert here. Dave's the expert. His marriage is still going strong.
The Race for the White House. Special coverage on KSL News Radio.
Oh, it's still going. This is not a sprint. It is a very slow-moving marathon. The actual election isn't until next November. But yet here we are on the day of yet another, a second Republican presidential debate.
It is incredible how long we've been talking about this. I mean, it was incredible. I'm trying to think. Remember, it was shortly after Ron DeSantis had won in a landslide victory in Florida as governor. And within weeks and months, it was like, why hasn't he announced? he just got reelected as governor. Let the guy, and he literally had to go out and tell people, I'm focused on the legislative session.
Oh, that's right.
In Florida.
But I think,
and people are like, oh, but unbelievable.
But if I recall correctly, I think your take back then, at least when we were having kind of private off-air conversations about it, was like, we've got time, folks. Yeah.
We 100%.
Got some time. What is this? It's like microwave popcorn. You know, yeah. We have to have everything done in a minute 30 or something like that, or we feel burned by it. So there's this debate tonight at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in Simi Valley, which is in California. It'll air on Fox Business. Oh, just Fox Business? Really? I'm looking this up right now, but Fox Business, I mean, are we like, is this like, it'll air on your local, you know?
No, that's definitely, you gotta have the tier on that,
yeah,
Fox Business.
It's Fox Business. I was like thinking, why not just on the main Fox page? Okay, whatever. And also Univision. Okay, so at 9 o'clock tonight Eastern time. So that's 7 o'clock our time. And, you know, I was shocked when 7 candidates made the stage. Shocked, because I thought they were going to just dump a bunch.
We were supposed to narrow it down a little bit. Okay.
They only booted one.
But tell me, who do you get rid of? Because I'm looking at this list right now, and there's only one obvious name that I would boot, that I do not want to hear from, and that is former North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum. Like, he's barely polling. I don't know how he's still
in the
race.
That's what I thought, too. I was surprised he made it.
But okay, if we're going to narrow it down even more, so which is going to happen in the third debate, which of these names would you kick off?
So can I just let our listeners know, because they might not know, that Asa Hutchinson, I mean, you might not know Asa Hutchinson anyway, but he's the one that they didn't allow back on the stage. And North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum is the one that we're thinking, why are they letting him? So they're down to seven. So go
yeah, on. They poll the lowest, Burgum and Asa Hutchinson. So, but do you want to learn and hear more from Chris Christie, Mike Pence, Tim Scott, Nikki Haley, Vivek Ramaswamy, and Ron DeSantis?
Is that a rhetorical question? Are you literally asking me to boot one of these if I were in charge? Now, I know there were parameters. I think you had to have like 50,000 individual
donors.
Yep.
New donors.
New donors and stuff. And so there was some formula that they used. Don't care about the formula. What I care about is it's like a lot of oxygen getting sucked out of the room, and it's really hard for the people that I would want to hear from to expand on their thought process and how they would handle things if they made it to the White House. So I want to hear more from fewer, right? I want to hear more information from fewer people. So Doug, sorry, if it were my debate, I'm sorry. Got to just take a seat in the crowd. And, this is going to be an unpopular opinion. Chris Christie.
Really?
Yeah, I'm going to.
He did well in the last debate.
Send you off the island. Yeah. I'm going to send you off the island. Now, I think, and maybe that's because I'm not quite sure he's got what it takes to win the White House. Maybe I'm just looking for the people I think might win based on poll numbers. Maybe there's some hope there for former Vice President Mike Pence. Vivek Ramaswamy, I'm still kind of trying to figure out what he's all about. Every time I hear him talk, I'm a little more confused about what he's all about. Senator Tim Scott, I mean, I know Boyd has talked about him at length, and so I certainly want to give him a chance just because I, you know, respect Boyd's opinion. And Nikki Haley, thought she did really, really well. And Ron DeSantis, you know, maybe by the fact that he's the front runner of this crowded field, you can't shut the door on him yet. So yeah, it would be Doug Burgum, Chris Christie, and then let the other 75 candidates. It's a lot, Dave.
Yeah,
it's just a lot.
Yeah, there's six. There's seven that are showing up. Six that I think are polling almost identically. That's not true. Ron DeSantis is the clear leader of the second group. President Trump is 40-50% in the polls. Ron DeSantis is at 15%, depending on, you know, which poll you're looking at. You've got, you know, Nikki Haley and Ramaswamy and Scott kind of in that 8-10, 11%. Mike Pence, Chris Christie are the lowest rated, or they're polling the lowest of that group.
Okay. Who would you boot? You're just like, don't leave me hanging out there.
To be honest, I don't have a problem with a bigger group right now. Again, because okay. It is so early. I want to hear more from Chris Christie and Mike Pence, okay. And I don't mind it. I would like to see, as you said, I would like to see fewer people on stage. So I would actually like to divide up some of these things. You know, so if we have six candidates, let's have two different debates with three here and three there.
Okay.
And if there's somebody that you're interested in, the chances are you'd probably hear from them.
Do you feel like we're past an era where it's like, you know, the networks call the clear winner in the debate?
Yeah, I don't think anybody trusts those numbers anymore. I think there are so many opinions out there. It used to be very clear because you would watch it. A few of the major media outlets would declare a winner. But right now you have 1,000 newspapers and social media influencers.
That's what I was going to say. I think that social media has diluted the all eyes on the debate. I think we can go back and watch it, which is great. I love debates. Don't get me wrong. I don't even mind watching them. I just feel like there's going to be a lot of debates between now and then. And this started so early that I think I am feeling the wear down. I hope I'm not alone. But I think there's oversaturation, and we can get information now about candidates from websites if you just want to read their version of themselves, which I don't just do that. You know, I go and look at other, you know, media reports or maybe other issues that they've had in the past, or look up how they've handled certain pieces of legislation if they, you know, or how their state is situated financially. But there is so much information coming at us all the time that's where I think I'm feeling the, another debate.
See, I actually feel different. I think the more debates you have, the more people cannot just sit on their rhetoric and just speak in generalities. I think you have to pin down. I think about this most recent slate of debates from the GOP, the second congressional district between Bruce Huff and Celeste Molloy. We were starting to hear, because they had debated so much, very specific solutions.
Okay.
So they were talking about water. This is the first time I'd ever heard a specific solution. I heard it from Bruce Huff, and he said, one way is you create more water in California. So California doesn't need to draw as much water from the Colorado River. We don't need to send them as much if they can take care of some of their own problems. So he talked about a desalinization plant that he would support building in California so that California wouldn't have to steal so much from us. That is a, whether you agree with it or not, that is a specific, tangible result that only comes out when you get past the platitudes, get past the generalities, and into specifics.
Other hot topic of the day is this pandemic money that was infused into child care facilities, even home daycare facilities, that is going to, it's been exhausted, it is running out at the end of this week. And so there's been reports, the Deseret News has done some great reporting on this, that we are ready to go over a child care cliff, not only in Utah, but across the nation. Next, one of our producers is going to walk into studio here. He has just been struggling with finding and keeping his daughter in a child care setting. And he just told me moments ago, Dave, is the price of daycare at the place he keeps his daughter has already gone up a lot, and he's worried that this pandemic money running out is going to drive up the price even more.
Dave and Dujanovic.
It's called a child care cliff, and we are set to go over the edge of it this weekend. Why? Well, I think a lot of us probably don't remember this, but back in 2021, Congress infused a lot of money into the economy. We know that part, but what we didn't realize is there were billions of dollars infused into child care facilities, whether there's at-home facilities or, you know, brick-and-mortar buildings that we, you know, drop our kids off at. That money is going to expire. It's exhausted at the end of this week, which is Saturday, and the fallout from it will most likely be felt in terms of child care centers needing to cut back staff, according to surveys that have been done of directors of child care centers, and also having to raise prices.
Yeah, and this is going to be brutal for families that have kids that are dealing with daycare. It was all part of the American Recovery Act, and it was tens of billions of dollars. I think it was $24 billion that was set aside. They would be sent directly to the daycares, and then they could use that kind of however they wanted to either pay for mortgages or leases, however they wanted to use it. And that money's drying up.
So the New York Times, and I read this actually, this article, the Deseret News, and they cited a New York Times article saying that one of the daycare providers here in Utah said she used the pandemic grant money to raise her staff's hourly wages to $15 an hour. And then when the grant ends, she's going to have to raise tuition. It would be really difficult to go into work on Monday morning and call a staff meeting and say, we are going to take your wages back down to $12 or $10 an hour, where they were pre-pandemic, because we know that daycares, I mean, they really took the brunt of a lot of this. They had to shut down, and then families went home, and they didn't go back to work, and so they weren't taking kids to daycare. So this was, that money was a way to, you know, give workers who returned or stayed with the daycare more, a higher wage, and compete with fast food restaurants. So this is going to be tricky if they do start rates even more. I'm looking at, I posted this on Facebook earlier today, Dave, and people are paying $1,200 a month, $1,100 a month just for one child.
Carlos Artiles Fortune is joining us right now. He's a producer here at KSL. And Carlos, we've talked to you in the past about your daycare situation because you have a three-year-old. You've been doing this for probably a year and a half. What's the going rate?
Right now, we actually got a notice last week that it was raised to $250 a week. So I used to pay $225 weekly, and now it's going up.
Another $25.
Another $25.
So, okay, so $100 a month.
$100 more a month is. And what did you start her at? Was it $225 or it was it even cheaper than
that? It was $225, and it's usually more expensive the younger they are. So
okay.
When she moved to an upper class, we were, oh, that's great. It's going to be $200. Fantastic. That lasted 2 weeks because we were informed that it was going to be $225. And then, yeah, 10 months later, now they're raising it to $250.
Wow. What can you afford, or is there a breaking point, or is this just one of those situations where you both work and you have to pay whatever the going price is?
It's that situation. I mean, both my wife and I work here in Salt Lake City, so we just have to do it and upfront it. I don't think we can afford right now to not have a school option.
So I mean, this might be a little personal, but I wonder how this is impacting families' decisions nowadays to have more than one or two children if you're looking at $1,100 a month or, in your case, $1,000 a month right now for just one child. Is this a consideration?
Oh, we've talked about it. We want to have a second kid, and it is something that has definitely raised our concerns because, you know, we always want to be have a year with the baby and then move to daycare. And we have done the math. I'm like, well, if we wait until our first one is five, we can kind of have...
Because she'll be in school.
She'll be in school. It will be less money, you know, because I don't think we could afford to have two kids in daycare. That's something that we definitely couldn't do.
So what does the schedule look like? How many days a week does she go and for how many hours?
She goes every day, Monday through Friday.
Okay.
Thankfully, I come in a little bit later, so I take her in at around 9, and then my wife picks her up at around 5.
Okay, so an 8-hour day that she's there.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm looking at it, and I think, listen, I feel the pain. I've been there with you, but $1,000 for full-time daycare, that breaks down to about $6.25 an hour. If you're talking about what you're paying to have your child there, and I think – well, what are the people getting paid? What are their hourly wage, Deb? And you said a lot or had moved up to about $15 an hour. And well, if that's the case, then you can see how it's not like these daycare centers are raking in money hand over fist. Mm-hmm. You can see their margins are probably pretty slim themselves.
Yeah.
I know that doesn't help you at all, Carlos, because all you see is, wow, this is such a strain on our family.
Yeah, and I love the school. I mean, she loves her teachers, you know, but yeah, it's definitely, it's hard. It's very hard.
You're concerned that with this pandemic money running out, that the price tag will go up even more?
A little bit, yes, because I mean, there's so many factors and, you know, the school has a lot of kids. They have a lot of staff. They're all great. And, you know, even maybe the quality going down, maybe not even the price, but if they have to cut staff or anything, that's just kind of what I'm worried about.
And you, I remember your journey trying to find daycare for your little one. That was already tough. You were very stressed out in the newsroom about it, if I am remembering the scenario,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, we had barely moved and we wanted something near our house, and that's complicated. And I think we were 3 to 4 months in the wait list when we found the daycare, but before, we just didn't even know we could find anything that had anything less than 6 months of a wait list.
I think we have looked into some solutions. So obviously what is going on right now is you've got a federal grant program, so federal money that is helping subsidize. But we've also discussed some of the private sector solutions, like perhaps an employer could offer some sort of on-site daycare or child care. Sometimes these are offered at elementary schools, at hospitals. They sometimes offer these things. Would that play a role in you choosing where you work? If they offered child care as a benefit, so to speak, would you be willing to sacrifice money or some other benefits to have child care at work?
I think so, because you're not sacrificing money. I think you're probably saving money if it's right there, it's peace of mind, you're next to them, you know. That would be a huge benefit. Yeah, that would definitely – I would think about where I work. If there was something that was offering me that, that would be amazing.
So Carlos is one of our producers here at KSL News Radio and is talking to us because he's got buy-in, like a lot of other Utah families, with this this concern about this cliff that the child care money is going to go over after the weekend. It's going to be exhausted, and there's potential that we're going to have – child care centers will have to cut staff, potentially raise tuition to make up for the money that they will no longer be receiving. You're from Spain.
Yes.
How do they do it in Spain?
In Spain, school starts when they're three. So it's very easy. Like, you don't have to worry about, you know, work and life schedules. It's a lot easier because once they turn three, we have public schools, you know, and they just go to school like regular kids.
Full-time?
Full-time.
Full-time at three?
Yep.
Man, I have a heart attack about sending kindergartners full-time at five, and they send them at three. But I can see where that would be an absolute home run as far as child care.
Yeah.
Carlos, thank you for joining us.
David Buchanan.
Okay, so I'm so excited to talk to Amy Kobabe about this, Dave. She's doing a special for this Saturday. It airs 4 o'clock p.m. Of course, it's conference weekend this weekend. We will be airing conference, all sessions of conference, starting at 10 o'clock Saturday morning, 4 p.m. Swiping Left on Danger, How the Dating World Has Changed. And so she is doing a full hour on online dating.
I love this. I'm a little jealous because I think I would have loved online dating back in the day. I think I would have loved it. I think I would have dominated it. I think I would have been great at it. Because it was very, very difficult to just walk up to a girl and ask her out. That is scary. And I'm like not
I didn't know
a
that.
Wimp. I'm not afraid to go talk to people, but that was still something that it was hard. It would be far easier to swipe. Oh, we matched. Boom. And then you start up a conversation. It seems like the easiest possible dating. It feels like a date cheat code.
Amy.
That's because you haven't done it, Dave.
Right? That's exactly. I think this is the hardest way of dating. It's so difficult, in fact, that I stopped.
You're not
I
alone.
Stopped in January. I'm like, I'm done. I'm just done. I'll just be single the rest of my life. This is working out well for me anyway. So So Amy, take it away.
Yeah, burnout is a really big issue that a lot of people using dating apps have. So the research shows that dating apps are now the number one way that people meet. So about half of college students in Utah, this was a couple years ago, were using dating apps. I imagine that number has grown since the pandemic when, you know, you couldn't, there weren't even classes that you could go to at BYU or at the U to meet someone. You had to basically try to find them online. And so, mutual friends and meet cutes and meeting at church or at school really is kind of the old-fashioned mode of dating. But there are a lot of roadblocks still that people are running into where they're expecting, just like you said, Dave, for it to be really easy. But what they're finding is they're getting ghosted. That's where you're just ignored.
Catfished. Where the person isn't who they say they are.
Or targeted as a victim of some crime, right? And so there are a lot of issues that people have to deal with, all while just trying to find someone to love them. And so there's a few things. People in Utah are actually, what I found was there's growing popularity for things. I don't know if you've watched the Netflix specials on matchmaking, but that's mm-hmm. growing in popularity here in Utah.
Where it's more fine-tuned. Where you hire somebody to find you somebody to love you.
What?
And to love
me.
Yes,
that's
coming.
We're going back old school matchmaking.
I've heard this. In fact, a friend and I was talking to me about a year ago that she was contacted, I think, by a matchmaker.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So matchmakers, where people are paying a lot of money, thousands of dollars mm-hmm. for someone. A part of it is really to just have someone say, hey, let's change your hair. Let's get a haircut.
Consultants.
It's okay. Basically a dating consultant. And then they have access to all sorts of people who've signed up in their kind of online portal to go on dates and to be set up with people with this matchmaker.
So Amy Kobabe in studio with us right now. This Saturday at 4 o'clock, Swiping Left on Danger, How the Dating World Has Changed. You spoke to a couple who met online, right?
Yeah. So a couple that lives now in Woods Cross, but they have kind of an interesting start. He was here in the U.S. going to school, not from the U.S. He's from India. She is from here in Davis County. And the kind of couple that would not have met if not for dating apps. And they met, and I talked to the husband. His name is Rupak Kumar, and he talked a lot about how it really was a struggle for years, but eventually he became grateful for that.
And I met her, and then, you know, after being in that 5 year of our marriage, like, I often think back and tell myself, like, I'm so glad that those relationships did not work. I'm just so glad that either they denied me or I denied them. I'm just so glad it didn't work. Yeah, I was sad, frustrated, but I don't think so. They would have loved me the way Brooke loves me.
That's pretty darn sweet. I
mean, that was a positive way to look at what can become a really draining and negative and sometimes scary experience being online.
Absolutely.
Dating.
Absolutely. And I spoke to a dating coach, someone who is a licensed therapist, a mental health counselor, who is made their entire job just helping people date and navigate this world. And she said that really is the goal, is to get them to kind of, you know, on that yellow brick road with a couple, and doing online dating is really how it's done. And so she has to help them kind of navigate that world, and a lot of people, she says, are successful at it. They're finding their person.
What are some of the pitfalls? And I'm not talking about the extreme pitfalls of real danger, predatory behavior. What are some of the pitfalls of online dating?
So one thing that this dating counselor said was people, they finally get to a first date. You know, they've been talking, they swiped on each other, they're talking a little bit, they get on the first date, and they're expecting the entire world on that first date. They're expecting to have this feeling, to just know if they're the one. And she says that has never been the case on a first date. Yeah. That's just not how it works. But when we talk about if we're in a relationship, when we talk about it, we're like, oh, we just knew, or oh, I'm so glad I found this person. And it's really not helping people who are meeting a total stranger, you know, at a coffee shop or getting ice cream, to just get to know each other. And so she said that really getting past that first date, especially when you have, you know, a list of people lined up in your phone that still want to meet with you and talk with you, is really difficult for a lot of people. And they never get maybe past that first date.
So the other thing too, just my experience, and Amy, you have a lot more information for us and experiences when you talk about this on Saturday afternoon, is the revolving door of first dates.
Absolutely.
Gets to be a drain. It's a drain of just no more coffee, please, you know,
and more frozen yogurt.
And it's also, and while it can be a drain, if you look at it from a positive thing, like, oh, at least I get to meet somebody new. Usually it's literally a revolving door. They're in your life for that 30 minutes or an hour, and then they're out of your life.
Yep.
And you have to spend that time kind of explaining who you are and what you're all about. And I've got 56 years of history, so that's a long conversation, you know, so it just gets to be, you know, you hope you can end up like the Kumar family.
Yes.
The Kumar couple found each other, you know, over a dating app and are living happily ever after, it sounds like.
Yeah, they are. One way you can think about this, if you haven't experienced it, is imagine trying to use LinkedIn to find your best friend. And that's all you have. And that's all you're using is LinkedIn. And you're trying to find one of the most important relationships, maybe the most important relationship of your life.
Yeah.
And
wow.
It's going to be pretty difficult.
That's
to
a
do
great
that.
Analogy. That's a great way. Because you mentioned LinkedIn.
Can we
LinkedIn,
talk to, oh, I'm sorry, Deb.
What's that?
I thought you were wrapping up. I totally interrupted you, but
no,
I just wanted to know.
Good.
Did you talk to a matchmaker?
I did. I spoke to a professional matchmaker who talked me through the process and has found a lot of success and a lot of people that have come to her. And she also works with a dating counselor and someone that she sets them up with to kind of help them through some of these roadblocks that people run into. And she still encourages people to use online dating because she says it's the best way to just up your chances of finding someone.
What else will you deliver for our listeners when your report airs at 4 o'clock on Saturday?
4 o'clock on Saturday. Really, if you have been part of this, if you've used online dating, you're going to find some solutions and some ways to, you know, just feel like you're seen. If you haven't, okay, it's going to be a great eye opener of, you know, what your kids or your grandkids are going through.
Yes.
And maybe how you can help them and be a support to them.
I love that because, like Dave said, I'm not online dating. And you said, but your kids are. Your kids are, or they will be.
You got to do it all. As soon as my daughter gets home from her mission, it's like, we got a matchmaker lined up. We've got online dating. And then you're going to hang out at football games. So we're going to do everything.
Home Depot.
They're not there either. All right.
Dave and Dejanovic.
Let's talk about this headline in USA Today, why Gen Z and millennials feel that their parents... What their parents had is impossible now. So they can't buy into that American dream. That's the bottom line. They feel like they cannot buy into the American dream.
Well, they kind of can't. If we're being completely honest, I want my kids to work hard. I want them to have aspirations. Mm-hmm. But what I experienced, I got into my first home at a fraction of the cost that it's costing them now. And even adjusted for inflation, it's still 30-40% more than what I got into. So, yeah, home ownership is not a slam dunk anymore. It's not a guarantee.
And USA Today does a great job of breaking this down by experience through the eyes of different, you know, 20-something and 30-something-year-olds. I'm going to get to some of those stories in just a moment. But here's where, for some of us, our kids, if they're in their late 20s, are at, and if they're in their 30s, this is what they're feeling. 65% of Gen Zers, okay, that's the swath of Gen Zers. 74% of millennials say they believe they are starting further behind financially than earlier generations at their age. So, you know, if we're at, you know, mile 100 right now, they feel like they're at mile negative 100. That's frustrating for them and concerning.
I think kids have always had a problem with expectations. They also think that they deserve what their parents have, not realizing that their parents have accumulated these things many times over decades. So I think there is a lack of patience that I've noticed with kids these days. There's a lack of patience.
Mm-hmm. Matt is quoted in this USA Today article. He says, it's a rising cost of living, high inflation, even higher mortgage rates, no more pensions that scare him. He lives in New York. Brandon lives in Texas. And they are going around the nation talking to different 20-something and 30-something-year-olds to get their perspectives. And Brandon says he lives in Texas. He graduated college in 2 years ago with a business marketing degree, and he's struggling to get a job in his field.
You know? Yeah, and that we have, oddly enough, Debbie, it seems like this week we've hit on so many of these topics. Mm-hmm. But we've seen recently, when you're talking about a degree, the return on investment is not what it used to be, especially for kids that were born in the, you know, 80s and 90s. It's not guaranteed that when you graduate with a degree that you're going to be able to find a good paying job with that degree.
Audrey, she lives in Honolulu. Oh, you know what her concern is. She'll never be able to afford a home. I mean, family home price there, median home price in 2022 was $1.1 million. So a lot of times I've heard that, you know, your home ownership will be your biggest windfall financially because of the appreciation. You know, if you can't afford to buy one and get into one, then it just financially kind of leaves you stuck.
There's a couple things that pop into my brain. Number one, the market will adjust. If it is truly the case that nobody can afford a home, then the housing market completely and totally collapses. So the housing market can't go so extreme that it prices everybody out of a home. So the market will naturally correct itself to allow the majority of Americans to purchase a home. I am convinced of that. Otherwise, you'd be working with just the richest of all of us, and you'd be only servicing a small fraction of people.
Caitlin, are you a Gen Zer or are you a millennial?
I'm a millennial.
Barely.
I mean, I was born in 95. We researched this yesterday. Gen Z starts in 96, so that's the reason I know that. But yeah, so barely millennial.
So Caitlin is our amazing producer. Love having her on the team. Actually, she's the captain of the team. How do you feel?
I feel overwhelmed. To put it like everything you just said is extremely relatable. It's just like I feel like the expectation thing, but it's because I was raised a way where it was hard and it was a goal, but it was like way more attainable than what it seems like now. I constantly feel like I'm just like clawing to get to something, some sort of stability with financial stuff mostly. But I think the home buying is one that in my mind I was pretty set on. Like, I wanted to buy a home within the next few years. That was a couple years ago. And I'm 28. 30 would be a nice goal. I still have time to do that. But that I've really kind of let that go a little bit because it's like, it's way too hard right now. There is not a place for that in my life at all because I'm still just trying to scrape the surface. But I don't think my family had a lot of money, but I have the stability here. My parents bought a home around my age, I believe. So it's just overwhelming. And you just feel like you're drowning all the time.
Is it difficult to separate the generations? So you look at the timeline and the benchmarks of your parents and you think, oh, well, that's where I should be. When maybe it needs to be delayed an extra 5 years. Maybe you're buying your first home instead of at 28 at 32 or 33.
Yeah. Which I don't know if it's hard. It's kind of what you had set in your mind of like, okay, this is a good benchmark, which 30 I think is almost older than what most people did at that time. I think my parents kind of had started that foundation a little later. But I do think that I personally can give myself the grace of not having to compare myself to other people, but I know that that's not the case. And the expectation from my parents and other people in that generation is where the pressure comes in.
I agree. So I was thinking, as you were saying, I feel like I'm drowning all the time. First of all, I got choked up because I mean, that's a hard emotion to deal with all the time where you're just, okay, money and I got this and then now houses just got more expensive and cars are off the rails expensive, the price of gas and but I do feel as though there is some pressure from parents. Mm-hmm. I feel I'm guilty of it to some degree. It's like, you got to, you know, this is the timeline of life. And, well, you know, and when are you going to have children? Yeah. You know? And so I think this is a moment for parents to sit back and ask their kids, their adult kids, how do you feel?
Yeah.
And if you feel like Caitlin on KSL News Radio, that you're drowning all the time, how can I help? And I don't necessarily mean that help has to be financial, but what can I do to be there for you? Caitlin, thank you so much, as always, for everything you do for the show and also telling us about how you feel.
Yeah. And I think part of it is we do need to think differently. Just because it worked in the past a certain way does not guarantee that it's going to work for the kids these days. The experiences that we've had, the paths we have taken, may not apply to the kids these days. And we have to be adaptable and maybe humble enough to realize that just because it worked for us, it doesn't necessarily guarantee it's going to work for them.
I want to remind you, you can always check out our stories and our segments at kslnewsradio.com, where we post our podcasts. And also, I'm looking through the glass. There's Maria. She's lined up, ready to go.
A stranger with a gun came upon two teens taking pictures under a rising full moon. But violence is only the beginning of this story.
Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are. And this is a big one.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and I've spent my career talking about how lives are undone by violence. The Letter is a podcast about how lives are remade. Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.